Okay, good morning. Thank you. Good to see you all. We are on Daf Yud Bet, as I've printed out for you. Our aim today is to go to roughly halfway down Yud Bet, Amud Bet, to the first Mishnah on that page. And then we've got one more Daf for the Perek, which is only one more Amud on Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, and we'll split that up. And next week, please God, we'll do that, finish off this perek and give maybe a couple of minutes of introduction to the next perek, and then the following week we'll start with that perek, which hopefully means that splitting that up won't take too much time. What we'll do today is basically an amud and a half, but it is a, as you can see, a dense and thick amud, but hopefully with a little bit of introduction it'll pass without too much complication. For those of you who have the art scroll, you will... For those of well, for those of you of the art scroll, there are like 13 pages for this daf, because there are copious footnotes which tells you that it's complicated, which is unusual, because usually if it's complicated, the daf itself is quite short, because there are tons of Tosfot around the side, but there isn't here. So we're going to try to make this as clear as possible. And we're finishing off something we started last time with the eighth mission of the Perek. There are 11 altogether. We're going to do 9 and 10 today of the Mishnayot, and then we'll have one more left next time. Or one and a half, I should say. If you're president of the United States, you have various powers. What is one unilateral power you have as a president of the United States that nobody else has? You can commute a sentence. Excellent. I wasn't even going to go that route. I hadn't thought about that. Executive orders I was going to think about. You can commute sentences. What are the legal requirements for you to be a legitimate candidate for the president of the United States, for you to be qualified?
American citizen or born in America.
There are two qualifications for you to be a president of the United States, and that's it. You have to be over 35, and you have to be born in the United States. And of course, well, I don't know anybody who's yet been challenged on being too young to be president while they're in office, but there have been a number of candidates who, when they're in office, have been hounded as being not born here. And that's not...
Obama.
In particular, most recently, Obama was... accosted for much of his second term with notions that he wasn't born here, that he was born elsewhere, and he needs to prove it with his birth certificate. And let's say, I mean, he provided a birth certificate, and there's been no evidence to suggest that's true. But let's say it came out that after 2 years in office, a president of the United States had commuted sentences, had written executive orders, and then it comes out they weren't actually born in the United States, i.e. they were not legally qualified. So what would happen?
The vice president.
So now the question, it'd be a big mess. That's what would happen. But legally speaking, they'd be disqualified for office. They'd have to be removed from office. And now the question would emerge. They weren't impeached. It wasn't like, okay, we don't like you now and you're out. What about everything you've done in the last 2 years? Are all the sentences that were commuted still commuted? People who left jail, do they have to go back?
No.
No, why not?
Double jeopardy.
So, right, so this is double jeopardy, so they can't go back to court, but maybe they just have to go straight back to jail, meaning the whole commuting of the sentence is a false document now. Wasn't legitimate.
He was president at the time.
Was he president at the time?
He was certified by Congress.
He was certified, so that's the question. And this comes up, Lahavdil, in cases sometimes when a marriage has fallen apart and... the husband won't give a get, and the Beis Din says, if you don't give a get, we're going to annul the marriage. He says, what do you mean annul the marriage? I've got the ketubah here, I've got the ketubah, we've got it on video. They said, oh, we'll find a way to invalidate the wedding as if it never happened. At which point, well, there are all sorts of consequences to having a marriage. You're just going to say none of them counted, and some will say, yeah, we have the ability to annul. So the question is, if somebody's removed from office, is it an annulment, or is it like impeachment, it ends now? So, Lahavdil, if a Kohen Gadol is serving as a high priest, and then 4 years into his tenure as high priest, it comes out he's invalidated. What are the qualifications to be a high priest? You've got to be a Kohen, basically. But there can be a Kohen who is invalid. A figure we mentioned right on the first daf of Makot. Doesn't come up too often. But
if he drinks?
That would invalidate service that he's done while drunk, but it wouldn't invalidate his office. It might cause some problems among his colleagues, but it is a halal. Somebody who is born from an improper marriage or an improper union. So even though they are, legally speaking, their father's a Kohen, they're a Kohen, if they were born from improper union, they're considered a halal, which kind of vacates their status as a Kohen. So let's say it comes out 3 years into a high priestship that he's a halal, he's not valid. What has this got to do with anything? Good question. We've said, how do you determine the end of a sentence for someone who's been sent into exile? The death of the high priest. And we've determined last time, if there was no high priest when the sentence was passed, they're stuck forever. An example is they killed the high priest. They killed the high priest, they're sentenced to exile, there's no high priest been reinstalled yet, they're stuck forever. There's no end to the sentence because there's no high priest whose death will atone for their presence and bring the sentence to an end. So what happens if while they are, they're all very happy, they've gone to exile, they suffer from nightmares because they killed somebody unintentionally, they feel really guilty about it, but they know that the high priest is in office, they've been waiting 30 years, and they know he's on the way out, he's in his deathbed, he's about to die, they're so excited they're going to go free, and then some documentary evidence comes out, as he's on his deathbed, he's not dead yet, turns out he was a halal, so he's now out of office, and they've got a new guy who's, you know, 25, just come into office. So the question now becomes, this invalidated Cohen, does his disqualification make it as if he was not a high priest? So there was no high priest when this guy went into exile, so he's there forever. Or is it as if he died and that makes everybody in the exiles go free? That's the question that was posed last time. And at the end of Daf Yud Aleph, the Gemara said, maybe this is a similar machloket to Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Yeshua, rather, had an argument. If a high priest is bringing korbanot, and then after he brings a korban, it was discovered that he's a halal, one view says, everything's valid up to now, we only look going forward, he's out. And one view says, no, everything retroactively, you're going to have to bring the korban tamid again. You have to bring all the korban out that he's done, none of them counted. And if somebody brought a korban chatat and they were so happy, the high priest themselves came down to do it, they're going to have to bring it again, it was all invalid. So he said, maybe it's the same debate about whether a high priesthood gets invalidated retrospectively or from now forward. So the Gemara says, no, I don't think so. So now we're starting at the top of Yud Bet Amud Aleph. Maybe that's not the same. Maybe there's a way to square the view that retroactively everything is invalid, but the korbanot still work for some reason. So I'll leave Rabbi Elazar at the top of the page. According to Rabbi Elazar, who took the view, what did Rabbi Elazar's view? That everything retroactively is gone. So according to Rabbi Elazar, everybody agrees he takes a retroactive view that's nullified. He can't possibly think it's only going forward. But within the view of Rabbi Yeshua that says only from now forward a korbanot pasul, he might think that you also don't go free from exile and retroactively he's considered not a high priest, but korbanot an exception. Manda amameitu Rabbi Yeshua, the view says it's as if he just died and everything only goes forward from here. They would take the simple reading of Rabbi Yeshua. Manda amabatla, but the view that says even retroactively his position as high priest is nullified. Ad kanok Rabbi Yeshua hatam, the only reason Yeshua says with korbanot everything is valid, dechtiv, because it says Berach Hashem chelo ufoel yadav tirtzeh, because God says he will bless works of his representatives and the work of his hands will be accepted. So there seems to be a carve-out view, even if you are nullified. So lahavdil, if the President of the United States discovered not to have been born here and he was vacated, you could say all the executive orders, they're valid because there's a certain law in the Constitution that says executive orders are always valid when signed by a president, which makes it, and the Supreme Court would rule he was a president at the time. We thought he was, so it works. But maybe commutations in a different passage of the Constitution should all be invalid. And that's the distinction made here, that all the exilees maybe would have to stay in exile forever without a Kohen Gadol, but the Korbanot would work going forward. Full stop, end of discussion. Now, last time the Mishnah stated that if somebody is sent into exile and they are the most skilled engineer who we need on the front of battle to help engineer our technology, otherwise we will lose the war, doesn't matter. You are stuck in exile, you cannot be brought out. There's a statement that is often used when somebody says this is an indispensable person. Anyone know what people say to that? Maybe it's just Rav Shechter, I've heard say it a few times, and I assume that it's a more spread statement, that the cemeteries are filled with indispensable people. Meaning that everyone thinks they're indispensable until they're gone, and then somehow or another we muddle through and we make it. So you think this guy's indispensable, he's in exile. He's not coming, it doesn't matter if he's the top general, doesn't matter if he's the top engineer, he's stuck. And the person who we noted was the best general, as an example from Tanakh, was Yoav ben Tsruya. I was a cousin of King David who was used as a general of the armed forces. Even if it's like Yoav, you can't go free. Now Yoav has a complicated history, and in the end, what happened to Yoav? And I'm familiar with the story. Take a wild guess. He's in Tanakh, and I'm saying something happened to him. Yeah, he wasn't quite beheaded, but he was dead. What's the go-to method of killing in Tanakh, by the way? Not in an execution, but just on the battlefield? An epominologist here? For some reason, it's always the fifth rib. I have no idea which is the fifth rib. They would say he was stabbed in the fifth rib. So Yoav was taken out under instructions by Shlomo, who said, have him killed. The heart is there? Yeah, that makes sense then. I guess you don't want to mess that up. But who's counting then? I guess they're used to it. So we mentioned Yoav. So as a meditation on that, we mentioned that Yoav himself made an error because Yoav tried to take refuge when they went after him. And there are a few places you can get refuge. One is in Ir Miklat, but what's another place where you can get refuge in Jewish life?
The
Mizbeach. Right. So I think we may have mentioned this at some point a couple of years ago, that in medieval Christian law, there was a rule that applied to cathedrals and churches called sanctuary. And if anyone's ever seen Hunchback of Notre Dame, the Disney version, they will run onto the steps and say, sanctuary, you can't hurt me. There are rules that in a sacred place, you can't commit violence. Doesn't matter whether you're a criminal or not, which meant that churches were full of criminals because they'd go there to take refuge. Or, well, maybe not criminals, people who are fleeing from the law. And Jews, there were many medieval tshuvot written about whether Jews were allowed to take sanctuary in these houses of worship, which ordinarily we say you can't go into a foreign house of worship. What if it's to save my life? Maybe that's worse, because it looks like you're saying this faith is saving my life. So the tshuvot written about that. But Yoav went to take sanctuary in the Mizbeach, in the Mikdash, and said, you can't kill me, na 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 na. At which point they said, no, I can, boom, you're dead. And Rabbi Yudah Marav said, "Shteitu yotar rabo d'shai." Yoav made two mistakes in that moment. Dichtiv, we're told, what did he do? V'yanas Yoav elo al Hashem. He fled to the tent of God. V'yachazek b'karnot to mizbeach, and he grabbed the corners of the altar and said, "You can't hurt me. I've got refuge." Now, a couple of the commentaries do point out, how does this scenario end for anybody? Meaning, he's holding there, and the soldiers say, "You're right. We can't hurt you." Surround the mikdash. How does this scenario end?
Just say that the recess is over.
Say that the recess is over, and then they all go back to work. But what are the alternative endings?
Drag them out.
Well, let's say they agree, we're not going to touch you. Let's say it really works.
Sooner or later, he's going to have to go out.
Either he'll have to go out eventually and they'll kill him, or... yeah, he'll starve to death. So this isn't ending well for him. So some of the commentary say, what does he gain? And the answer is... yeah, some of you say, so he wants to live a bit longer. It's not, you know, the quality of life isn't high, hanging onto this ideal. So others suggest, actually, if you were killed as a rebel against the king, what happened to all your property? The king took it. But if you died a natural death, your heirs would get it. And he wanted to hold on. So maybe I'll die, but at least my family will get to keep all my property. But if they kill me, it goes to the king. So either way, that's a side point. So Ta'a, he made two mistakes. End of the line is where Ta'a, next word is last thin line. Ta'a, one mistake he made. She'ena kolet el agagav hu tavis b'konotav. You only get refuge on the Mizbeach if you stand on top of it. If you hold the side, it doesn't work anyway. So he goes, na 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 na, and then they kill him, because that was mistake one. Mistake two, Ta'a she'ena kolet el Mizbeach v'etolam. And the other mistake he made is, he was reading psukim that say that the Mizbeach you can't take somebody from because they're protected. That's only true in the Bet Mikdash. That's not true in the Mishkan or when it's elsewhere. Utaves Mizbeach v'shilo, and he took the Mizbeach when it wasn't in Yerushalayim yet, so he was wrong on both counts. Abaya said, Bahanami metata, actually he made a third mistake as well, Tashe inakolet ela kohen v'odob shiadav hu zarhaya. Says actually the rule about refuge on the Mizbeach is incredibly limited and narrow. It does not apply to the public. You can't run in and just grab the Mizbeach on top of it and say, I'm saved. It only applies to a kohen who's in the midst of worship. I mean, it's got nothing to do with the sacred territory that protects whoever's there. It's a way to make sure that any worship or ritual being carried out can be finished without being interrupted. But if a Kohen's up there and is doing the avodah and then finishes, even on top of the mizbeach, they can be taken out. So it's a very narrow exemption. Full stop. And now we've got a very unusual description of a mistake being made by an angel who also sought refuge in one of the Irim Miklat. There will be three future mistakes made, Sarah Shalromi, by the archangel, it's one of those words you don't say out loud very often, the archangel of Rome. Rome, who is, in the rabbinic imagination, the overlords of our downfall, who are riding in the shadow of the Roman Empire, who is battering the people, scattering the population, and flattening the Bet Mikdash. In fact, the very last daf of Makot, please God, we'll get there soon, by Shavuos for sure, will be a description of us as a people standing in the shadow of Rome. In fact, it's one of the most famous episodes in rabbinic literature. We'll have Rabbi Akiva laughing when his sages are crying. That's how the Masechet finishes. How that connects to Irim Miklat and Adam Zomerman, we'll have to figure out along the way. So what are the three mistakes the angel of Rome will make? Tehtiv, we're told in a verse, Mizeh ba me'edom, this is in Yeshayo. Mizeh ba me'edom, who's coming from Edom? Chametz b'gadim mi'batzra, with stained clothing from Batzra. Now, Edom is Rome. Batzra is one of the cities that sounds like one of the cities of refuge. So the city of refuge called Betzer. And we're saying that this stained garment on God is coming from Rome, from Batzra. So the interpretation is, why is God's clothes stained with blood returning from Rome from a city called Batzra? This is how Reish Lakish reflects. Ta'a, the mistake was made by the angel of Rome, She'ina koletet ela Betzer v'hugala levatzra. So in the future, someday, the angel of Rome will say, oh my gosh, I slaughtered all the Jewish people. God's going to come get me. I'm like Yoav. I'm going to go and take refuge. So he ran to Batzra. Turns out, God says, no, mate, you're looking for Betzer. I'm going to take you out. So he slaughters him and he's covered in blood. So that was mistake number one. Second mistake, She'ina koletet ela shogev, who made it higher? Second mistake, you only get refuge if it was unintentional. And you, angel of Rome, have slaughtered intentionally our people. Which is, again, in the historic context, a reflection on, don't tell me this was political forces, don't tell me this was geopolitical interest, don't tell me you didn't mean to kill as many people, it was just casualties of war. What you are doing is fully intentional, and you will pay for it. Number two, Toa, number three, She'in Koledet Ela Adam V'hu Malachu. The most important mistake is, you're an angel. The cities of refuge only apply to human beings. God's not interested. Which, again, tells you, historically something about Rome, but also something about what cities of refuge are about. It's about human frailty. It's about unintentionality. It is not an ideal system that, like, oh, part of human perfection, this is how society should function. Politics is filled with necessary evils, and the city of refuge is a necessary evil because human beings should live intentional lives, attentive lives, which is not angelic, and the angels have no excuse. Amar Babaru. Babaru says, a final reflection connected to how long the sentence is. Irim Miklat lo natli legvura. And this is an important point. Talking about Irim Miklat, we've already noted that it is a place not to just incarcerate the unintentional killers, but it's a rehabilitation center. They're meant to live there. There's meant to be water resources. Meant to be marketplaces. It's meant to be an absence of weapons. Meant to be teachers in schools, libraries. So we've now got the notion that Rabbi Rahu says, Irim Miklat, there can be no burials. There are no cemeteries. In Irim Miklat. Why not? So that's what we suggested last time. When the Kohen Gadol dies, anyone who was buried in Irim Miklat, the body gets disinterred and sent back to the family, which makes it sound like you do get buried in Irim Miklat. So why would we just said you don't get buried there? So we said there's no burial there, dechtiv, as it says in the verse, to megreshem you levehemtam, because their open field areas will be for their animals, lechusham lechol chayotam, and for their property, and all their life needs. So the whole city, the cities of Levites, cities of refuge, are designed for living. There should be no death there, no permanence there. Mate, we've got a question. We said last week, you have to be buried there if you were sent there in exile. So the bottom line is, if you are an unintentional murderer and you are exiled as part of your sentence, you are buried there until the Kohen Gadol dies. But if you're living in the city of refuge as like population movement, or you're a Levi living there and you were sent there, you do not get buried there. The cemeteries are outside the city. The only people, bottom line, who get buried in Eir Miklat are people who were sentenced there, and it's part of their sentence to be stuck there until they can come out. Which makes you wonder, if it is about rehabilitation, they're dead. What do they need to be there for? Which tells you maybe there's another reason they're there. The Sefer HaChinuch suggests there are actually three reasons why people are sent to Eir Miklat, one of which is nothing to do with the murderer, and everything to do with the surviving family members. In the view of the Sefer HaChinuch, part of the intention of putting away these people is to shield the surviving family members from having to see the person who killed their family. I don't want to see you. When the Kohen Gadol dies, there's kind of a recalibration across the population, but I don't want to see you before that. So even if you're dead, you're buried there until the Kohen Gadol dies. Full stop. Keshem Sheha'ir Koletet, so this is in the gray, we say, just as the city shields you, so too does the Tchum. How big is a Tchum? 2,000 amos. That's how long far you can walk outside a city on Shabbos or in between cities. And we said that if you're in the Tchum, you are protected. By the way, we'll get there. Okay. Urmini, you told me that the Tchum protects you. We've got a contradiction to that. V'yeshev ba. The Pasuk says that you have to dwell in it. Ba v'lo b'tchuma. You have to dwell in the city of refuge itself, not in the Tchum. So it makes it sound like the Tchum is not a place where you can shield yourself in the Eir Miklat. Amar Abaye says, Lakasha, no problem. Kan liklot, kan lador. It is true that you're not allowed to live in the Tchum, but it protects you, which is, again, an interesting division. You cannot live in the boundary area. What would be the... we're at the edge of Queens now, right? Meaning Jamaica States is like on the very boundary.
Is it? New Hyde Park.
Oh, that's the edge, and then it's Long Island, I guess.
Yes.
So, if you live West Hempstead, that's Long Island, right?
Yes.
Is that close to Queens?
Yes.
And then 2,000 amos?
Queens is close to everything.
Right, Queens is close to everything, that's true. So, if you're living, if you're talking about 2,000 amos outside Queens, you're not allowed to live there if Queens was near Miklat. But if you were found there, it protects you. Why can't you live there? Meaning, what's wrong with living in the Tchum? If that's going to protect me anyway, why can't I live there? And it's going to turn out that there are rules and regulations in Jewish cities about green belts. Is that a thing in the United States, to have green belt land? I know that in England that is. No? Sounds like the Green Line. So are there any nature preservations in cities where they insist you have to have trees and you can't have people and homes? So it turns out in Jewish law, the Levite cities have the same rules. There has to be 1,000 amos around the Levite city. Nobody lives there. Nobody is agricultural there. It's just natural land. Why? Rashi says?
Tourism.
Well, to make it pretty. They say that there's an obligation for Levite cities to have an aesthetic look, an aesthetic feel to them, which is they're surrounded by greenbelt land, where nobody's using it for their agriculture or farming and no one's allowed to live there. And that includes an exile. You can, if you're there taking a walk in the Tchum, in this open land, you can't get killed, but you're not allowed to live there because the city has to be preserved. So again, if you're thinking about utopian Jewish visions, what do cities look like? There has to be parks to make sure that there's public land. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks has in his book, the... Letter in a Scroll has an essay about Shabbat, which he compares to parks as being a kind of public civic space in time and in space. He talks about the importance of parks politically over the course of British history, which I guess we could also tie into here. Say again? Oh. So, Lokasha kan liklot kan lador, meaning you're not allowed to live in the Tchum, but you are protected there. Full stop, last word on the line is lador. Lador, if you're going to tell me that you can't live there, Tebukley, I already know you can't live there. How do I know that nobody's allowed to live in this open land? We just said there's a rule around Levite cities. Enos in Sade Migrash, Velo Migrash Sade, Velo Migrash Ir, Velo Ir Migrash. There are three areas to the Levite cities. There is the city itself. Then there's 1,000 amot around it called the Migrash. Do they have that at Bnei Akiva camp? What is it?
It's called a camp.
What is Migrash?
Playground.
Playground?
You said Bnei Akiva camp there in front of the campus as Migrash, like the middle of the campus open area.
Oh, interesting. So that's Migrash means open area. And then 1,000 amos around that with the Sadot, where you had the agriculture. The agriculture, why would you put the agriculture, by the way, right on the outskirt, not first? Anyone been involved in farming? I assume there are smells involved. I mean, anyone who's got family in Karen Biavna, there are smells involved with farming, so you're going to put that right on the outskirts, then you've got 1,000 amos of like a green belt, a Migrash, and then you've got the city. And halachically speaking, the Gemara says, no one is allowed to live in the Migrash or in the Sadeh. Those have to be completely non-residential areas. So why do you need to tell me, oh, that the exilee, the Goleh, can't live there? No one can live there. So why do you have to tell me that? And here's the exemption. Amar of Yeshesha. Yeshesha says, lo nitzroche elele michilot. It's talking about tunnels. Tunnels are very important. Now, and this is an interesting distinction. We've just said, halachically, no one is allowed to live in the Migrash because you need a pretty area around the city. What happens if somebody digs underneath the Migrash and lives in a tunnel underneath? Would you say that that's in violation of Greenbelt laws? You can say, underground city, it still looks pretty on top, you can live there. What would your instinct be? You're not allowed to live in the Migrash. What about living under the Migrash? What would your guess be?
I would say no.
You would say no because? Oh, interesting. Meaning you're flaunting the rules. Interesting. So it turns out it's going to be, your instinct will be true for the exilee. Meaning if you're an exilee, you cannot live in this area, whether you're on top or underneath. But if you're just a Levite or your population member, you're allowed to live underneath because it doesn't ruin the aesthetics of the city, so you can have a tunnel underneath. But if you're an exilee, you can't, which raises the question, what's the difference? Why should someone who's an exilee not be able to live underneath if it's not in violation? And it seems that, again, the whole purpose of going to exile is to be rehabilitated as a member of society. And if you're living in some tunnel under the Migrash, it may be you're not in violation of the aesthetic principles, but you're not using this as a chance to learn how to live as a human being. Full stop. Now we've got a complicated case where the unintentional murderer leaves the city. What happens if you leave the city of refuge and you're a murderer? Fair game. So that's what we kind of intuitively taught, and that's the way we've been carrying it. You can get killed. So in the last Mishnah, there was a debate. Rabbi Kiva says, Rashut, the Goel Adam can kill you, and anybody else? If they try to kill you, what if I see somebody leave the city of refuge, nothing to do with me or my family, I see them leave and I say, I want to kill you. Yeah. Right, so Rabbi Kiva says, you can't, nothing to do with you, the Goel Adam can. Rabbi Yossi Haglili took the view that if you're a Goel Adam, you have a mitzvah to kill the person. Meaning, I want to move on, I've put it behind me, I don't want to kill them, you've got a mitzvah to kill them if they leave the city of refuge. And everybody else, fair game. I see them come out, I can kill them if they want, you're out of bounds. I mean, this is not how things work here, but if somebody escaped from death row in the United States, obviously, if you see someone escape from death row, what do you have to do as a citizen? Well, run, actually. Yeah. What are you legally permitted to do as a citizen? If you see somebody escape jail or police custody, what are you permitted to do as a citizen?
Citizen's arrest.
You can do citizen's arrest. I don't know how legally that works. And I don't think it would work very well. I mean, officially, we could all do this to anybody right now. We could perform a citizen's arrest. I don't know how it works or why that works or why anyone would listen. But the suggestion is, if somebody fled Ir Miklat, citizen's arrest is hyped up, Rabbi Yossi Haglili, and anybody has permission to kill them, can kill them. So there are two views, again. Rabbi Akiva says, Goel Adam can kill. Rabbi Yossi Haglili says, the Goel Adam has to kill. So we're going to repeat that argument here. Tan Rabbanan, the rabbis talk. V'rotzach Goel Adam v'rotzach, and the Goel Adam killed the murderer. Sounds like Rabbi Yossi Haglili is going to say, mitzvah b'yad Goel Adam. It is a mitzvah to kill this escapee if you're a family member. Ein Goel Adam reshus b'yad Goel Adam. If there's no Goel Adam, anyone else is permitted. Rabbi Yossi Haglili. That's his Rabbi Kiva. Rabbi Kiva says reshus b'yad Goel Adam. Goel Adam chayav malav. Rabbi Kiva says the view which traditionally we associate with, which is a Goel Adam is permitted to kill, and nobody else is allowed to, they would be liable for killing. My time to Rabbi Yossi Haglili. Why does Rabbi Haglili think it's a mitzvah? Mikdiv imratzach. It doesn't say if the family member kills, it says v'ratzach, and he kills. Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva's response is Mikdav Yirtzach. It doesn't say he will or shall kill, it just says and kills. Full stop. So there's debate about reading the pasuk, whether it's a family member is an obligation to kill or the permission to kill, which again gives a radically different understanding for what exile is about. And is it to protect the person from the emotional state of the family who we're trying to contain, or is it a forcible rehabilitation that we insist the family member kill them if they leave, and it's meant to attune them to sensitive living? So, Amra Marzutra Bartuvia Amar Rav. Marzutra said in the name of Rav, Rotsech Shiasachos Litzchom, he's now going to quote a view in the name of Rav that doesn't fit anybody's view so far. If the Rotsech left the city of refuge, Mansa Goladam, the Goladam found the Hargo Neragalav, and the Goladam killed them, the Goladam is killed. Whose view is that? The Goladam killed somebody who fled the city of refuge, and we say, you are going to be put to death. That doesn't make any sense. Come on, look, Rabbi Akiva. Yosek Lili said you have a mitzvah. Rabbi Akiva says you got reshus. Who's putting you to death as a Goladam? Who da ama ki atana da tanya Rabbi Lezer? He's taking the Rabbi Lezer, who we'll see right now. Rabbi Lezer's got an incredibly unusual view. Ad amdu lifnei ha'edah lemishpat. There is a verse that says you cannot do anything to a criminal until they've stood in judgment before the community. Mal Talmud Lomar, what's being taught here? Lefisha ne'emar, since it says rotzach gol adam et rotzach, that the gol adam can kill the murderer. Yachol meyad, you might think as soon as they leave the city, the gol adam can kill the murderer. Talmud Lomar, ad amdu lifnei lemishpat, full stop. He says, no, actually, the gol adam is never, ever, ever allowed extrajudicially to kill an unintentional murderer. And this is not, again, a traditional view. What is the Goladam allowed to do? He's allowed to take patrols, keep lookout, and if he sees the guy flee the city of refuge, what does he do? He takes him to Beis Din and said, I found him outside the city of refuge, and if the case is proven that he was outside the city of refuge, who puts him to death? The Beis Din, who appoint the Goladam to do it. Which again is a radically different view, where we imagine it's kind of the Wild West vigilante justice, that he's kind of waiting there to shoot him out, which is going to be the bottom line view we take. Rabbi Lazar says that's inconceivable, that we would permit people to go around just killing people with no evidence. Meaning what would happen if I'm a Goel Adam and I hate this guy, and he killed my family, and he says it was unintentional, but he should have known better. I'm going to spend the rest of my life trying to find a way to kill him, and then put his body outside the city and say I found him here. No evidence. Rabbi Lezer says, it's unthinkable. It has to be that you have to take them to court, prove the case that they had left the city, say, I saw him here, there are two witnesses that saw him leave, and now I can put him to death. That's Rabbi Lezer's view. That's not the view we follow. So bottom line is, it does seem to be extrajudicial killing permitted. First one line is, Amdu, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Akiva have to do something with the sentence that say you've got to wait for the court to pass judgment. Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Akiva, Hi, ad amdu lifnei ha'edah lemishpat, my darish bay. What do they do with this sentence that says you have to wait until they're adjudicated in court? Homa b'ayle l'chadetanya, they need it for the following teaching. Rabbi Kiva, Omer, Rabbi Kiva said as follows, Minayin l'Sanhedrin, imagine, I don't know if this has ever happened in the history of the United States legal system, where somebody has committed a crime in court during session. Are there any cases of that where someone's like killed somebody? I know there was a movie where this happened. Somebody killed somebody on the stand. Oh, maybe there was like some mob cases where that happened.
They're rare, but there have been cases where family
or in the movies.
Oh, so that, oh, interesting. This was, I can't remember the name of the Olympic doctor who abused all the Olympic.
NASA.
So there were. He was sitting on the stand listening to witness impact statements, and there was one father of one of the young women who'd been abused by him who could not contain himself with the guy just sitting there, and he broke through the bailiffs or whatever they're called and started attacking NASA. He didn't get very far because they restrained him. In theory, that's a crime, that's battery. So the question is, if you do a crime in court, does that make any difference? So again, that was a unique case, and that was treated uniquely, and he had to give a public apology and to the judge and whatever it was. But what if you kill in court? So Rabbi Kiva says this pasuk tells you that court is not allowed to adjudicate the case. You're all biased. If it took place before you, you're never going to be open to exculpatory evidence. You saw it and you felt it. So Rabbi Kiva says, how do I know that that court can't put them to death, but somebody else needs to? They have to go before another court because you will be biased. Full stop. Now, here's an interesting question. Let's say I am a clumsy guy. And I'm just doing unintentional things all the time. And unfortunately, usually my mistakes lead to, you know, I bump my foot and I spill my tea. I killed somebody unintentionally. So I get sent into exile. And I am a congenital unintentional criminal. So I'm going for a walk. I say, I'm going to have a hike in the Migrash. And what do I do by mistake? We'll get to if you kill somebody by mistake in Eremit Klal at the end of the page. Yeah, I am going for a walk, and unintentionally I leave the Eremit Klal by mistake, which is obviously a ridiculously stupid thing to do, because now I might get killed, but it was unintentional. So if I'm the Goel Adam, and I'm looking through my binoculars, waiting for this guy to try and escape, and I'm like, this is unbelievable. He is accidentally walking out. This is insane. So walking into my am I allowed to kill him, or is this shogeg, and I can't kill him? Or is it, you're out the boundary, it's fair game. So... Say again? Well, that's also true. I guess if you could walk along pretending it was unintentional, I guess you'd know it was unintentional if he, like, put on a blindfold and, like, went for a walk, and then you saw them leave. And say, I don't know why he's playing... Right, exactly. Like, he's playing pin the tail on the donkey and he walks out by mistake. Or if you know that they had redrawn the boundary last night or something and you, there's no way anybody else could know. I don't know, but you're right. It's a good question. So... Tana Rabbanan, the first one on the line is Acher. Tana Rabbanan, Acher rather. Im Yatza Yatza Rotsech. The verse says, if the murderer surely leaves, you are allowed to kill him. Einli Ela B'mezid. That sounds like if he leaves intentionally. B'shogeg Minai. And how do I know if he leaves unintentionally, you can kill him? Tamad Lama Im Yatza Yatza Mikom Makom. It says Yatza twice. It doesn't matter if unintentional, so you don't have to worry about the case, because if he leaves the boundary at any point, you can kill him. Hatanya, it was taught in a brighter, b'mezid neharag b'shogeg gola. But the brighter disagrees and said, if they left intentionally, he can get killed. But if he left unintentionally, you re-exile him. You kind of say, I know this has been reiterated to you. Go back in and stop leaving by mistake. Take the blindfold off. Lokasha, so we've now got a contradiction. We've got one view that says if it's unintentional, yatza yatza, you can be killed. And a brighter that says if you went out unintentionally, you just get re-exiled. What do they do with Yatza Yatza? Lo kasha. Hankamandam amrina debratok lashmne adam. Hankamandam lamrina debratok lashmne adam. There are two views about whether the Torah, when it says Yatza Yatza, you can read anything into the extra world. Or maybe it's just speaking like human beings speak. And if they leave, you can kill them. But if they do it by accident, you shouldn't. If they do it unintentionally, you have to send them back. And Abai is actually going to take the view that it's much more coherent sense to say that if they leave unintentionally, you're not allowed to kill them. So actually what is emerging here is all sorts of limitations, where we've got the Vuv Ribba Lev that says the Goel Adam's never allowed to kill them. They have to take them to Beis Din. And now we can have, if you leave unintentionally, you're not allowed to kill them. And Asami says, how do I know if someone leaves unintentionally? Suddenly, as a Goel Adam, I'm living with a lot of inhibitions. Because if I kill this person and it turns out they left unintentionally, I'm going to be put to death. So now I've got all sorts of... I'm not going to sit there with my bow and arrow kind of trigger happy, because I've got to assess, was it an unintentional, was it not unintentional? Rabbi is going to say, Mistavra commando dibratok lashmanei adam. It makes much more sense to say that the Torah, when it says yatza yatza, just means if they leave, but it doesn't mean included shogeg. And if they left b'shogeg, you can't kill them. Shlo yesef v'cham mitchalato. It's impossible, Rabbi says, that it's going to be more strict if they leave irmikla than the actual killing. Meaning they killed somebody unintentionally, and what was the consequence? You go to Galus. Now they leave Galus unintentionally, and they're going to get killed? It doesn't make any sense. Why should it be so strict? He says that it's one continual punishment. You go into Galus. If you do anything intentionally at this point, you get killed. But unintentionality can never lead to being killed. We said there's only one case. This is a trivia that I don't think I'll remember going forward probably, but it's somehow still in my head. One case where someone does something b'shogeg and gets killed for it. And remember that one unique case where somebody does something unintentional and is put to death. There's only one case I think we came across, which was a Ger Toshav killing a Jew. If a Ger Toshav kills a Jew b'shogeg, they're put to death, which was a kind of an exceptional case, which means that if you are a permanent resident and not a citizen, you have to be pretty intentional about your life, because you can get killed for being unintentional. Tanichara, it was taught, and this is a if you're thinking about a family drama, I actually never saw The Sopranos, but I'm told it's like the best television in history, and maybe I'll see it at some point. But what happens if this clumsy person unintentionally, tragically, kills his son? He's 80 years old. He kills his 50-year-old son by mistake. Who are the Gol Adam now? If he killed his son, let's say he's got a big family, who are the Gol Adam? So his other son. So are you allowed to kill your father as a Gol Adam for your brother? That's going to be the question. And there's going to be two brises that seem to disagree. So Tan Rabban, the rabbi said, no, that's not where we are. Amar Abaya. No, Tani Chada. First word in line is Sofo, in the middle. Tani Chada, it was taught in one brayta. Av Shaharag Beno Nasi LaGol Adam. If a father kills his son, Beno, his other son, Nasi LaGol Adam, becomes a Gol Adam. Makes it sound like you can have, and again, according to Rabbi Yosi Aglili, you have a mitzvah to kill your father now. According to Rabbi Kiva, you've got permission to kill your father as a Gol Adam. Tani Idach, there's another brayta that says, Ein Beno Nasi LaGol Adam, that the son can never become a Gol Adam. Maybe you should say this is the very distinction. According to Rabbi Yosi Aglili, that it's a mitzvah, then you can be Gol Adam against your father. But if it's Rabbi Kiva, you've got permission, that does not override Kibud Av Va'Em, so you can't kill your father, maybe. And then the Gemara says, hold on a minute, what are you talking about? Even if you think it's a mitzvah, Rabbi Yosi Aglili, to kill as a Gol Adam, how could that ever be allowed in the case of a father? Says in the same name, l'chol, everywhere, the son can never ever be an agent of harm or curse to the father. Apart from a case of meisit, what's meisit? Am I familiar with the case of meisit? Correct. Yeah, so this is somebody who kind of, I don't know if you have the equivalent of Hyde Park in the United States, where people stand up on soapboxes and just say whatever they want. And we've seen The Life of Brian, there's kind of a marketplace where everybody gets up and convinces Congress, there you go. Thank you. People get up on their soapbox and say anything. So if somebody gets up and starts convincing everybody to worship an idol, that's the case of Meset, which is prohibited. And that is an instance where a son is allowed to kind of take out the father. Halachically, Shari Amrito, because the Torah says, Lo tachmal v'lo tachasa elav. Because in that instance, the Torah says, have no mercy in that case. Ella, so what do we do? Everybody would agree. Is that me? So it sounds like a son can never be an agent of harm to the father. Even if Rabbi Yosi Aglili, and you think it's a mitzvah to kill as the Gol Adam, it can't apply in this case. Ella lo kasha. Oh, they're talking about different things. The writer that says, if the father kills, the son becomes a Gol Adam. Whose son is it talking about? So a father kills the son, and it says the son becomes a Gol Adam. Whose son? We were assuming it meant the father's other son. What it actually means is the son of the victim, the grandson. And this is actually evidence used in a much more regular context, which is the question of whether grandchildren have an obligation of kibud av va'em to their grandparents. This comes up in the context, most commonly, unfortunately, with avelus. If somebody loses a grandparent, they often, certainly in our age, when people tend to live longer and have kind of deep relationships with grandparents, it feels odd that, you know, that direct children are sitting in chairs and not wearing shoes and not shaving and saying Kaddish, and grandchildren who may have spent hundreds of hours with their grandparents, there's no outlet for mourning. So there were questions about how as a grandchild do I mourning, and it turns out that most mourning practices result from a kibud av va'em. It's not directly for the mourner, it's more to honor the person who's departed. So the question is, do grandchildren have an obligation of kibud av va'em? And many people cite this text as evidence that they don't really, because you can be a Gol Adam to kill your grandparent. The only reason not to would be if your parent is still alive, and you honor your parent by honoring your grandparent. But in this case, what happened? The grandparent killed the parent. So it's a complicated dynamic. Either way, if that does come out practically, by the way, about grandchildren and mourning practices, it's a separate discussion. I'm happy to have it with anybody. But this is just summoned in that discussion. Full stop, new Mishnah. Whew. Okay. Ilan Shu, and now this Mishnah is going to deal with questions of boundary and borders. Any of you have ever had a boundary dispute with a neighbor? and if anybody currently having a boundary dispute with a neighbor,
it's
yes, so it's quite common. I think I mentioned a couple of years ago, my father was in the middle of a boundary dispute with his neighbor, which was because my father woke up one day and saw his neighbor's gardeners in his backyard cutting down his trees. And they said, well, they were leaning over into my garden. All right, well, if I lean over the fence, don't cut my head off. I mean, like, what does that mean? And they took the view. I don't know what the rule is here. I think somebody told me legally here, anything over a fence, you can cut without permission because it's in your territory. Is that right? Anything over the fence. You believe so. Good. There you go. So I know this can be a contentious issue. So now the question becomes, if it's more contentious than just you cut down my tree, but you're allowed to kill me if I'm outside of Ir Miklat. So let's say I'm this unintentional guy and I decide I'm going to climb a tree. And I climb up into the branches and the branches are over the boundary. But the trunk is in Ir Miklat. See, now I'm in the tree. The tree is in Ir Miklat. You can't kill me up here. And you can imagine this being a really irritating exilee hanging in the branches going, nah, 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 nah. You think I'm outside. I'm still in the tree. Are you allowed to kill him? So where are you if you're in the tree? That's the question this Mishnah deals with. Ilan shu omer b'tochat chum. If you've got a tree that is planted, so this is where this the diagram comes up. So you've got two cases here. We're going to say the Ir Miklat is where the grass is and where the wall is. That's the end of the Ir Miklat. So you've got a tree planted on the left with the trees inside Ir Miklat. On the right, the tree is outside Ir Miklat. So if you had to intuitively say, where do we determine where the tree is, what would your instinct be? That would be my instinct too. Think about where the tree is rooted. For some reason... Oh, interesting. So maybe it's to do with the branches, you're saying? Maybe we should define it by the branches. Alternatively, what might you say? Alternatively, you might say it just depends where you are territorially. If you're over the boundary, if you're not, you're not. So what's going to turn out is it sounds like for the Mishnah, everything for Ir Miklat follows the branches. Meaning this way, your roots are in here and you're on the trunk inside the wall boundary. If the branches are all outside, you're fair game to be shot. It's considered you're outside. That's what it sounds like. Everything follows the branches. In this case, if you're literally on the trunk, on a tree, outside Ir Miklat, but the branches all hang over the boundary, you can say, I'm in Ir Miklat, you can't hurt me. That's what it sounds like from the Mishnah. So, in the gray, Ilan Shu'on V'tochat Chum, if you've got a tree standing within the boundary, V'nofu Nota Chuzlet Chum, but the branches are all outside, O Omen Chuzlet Chum, or if you're standing on a trunk outside the boundary, V'nofu no. And the branches lean in. Hakol holech achar hanof. Everything follows the branches. Wherever the branches are, majority of them, that's where this tree is considered to be. That's where you're considered to be if you're anywhere on this tree. Which seems like an unintuitive division. Why? And we're going to get to that in a minute. But the first is Urimini. The first word in yellow is we've got a contradiction to this because it says in a Mishnah in Maaseh Sheni, Ilan Shehu Omed Bifnim. If you've got a tree that is rooted within a boundary, V'nota Lechutz, and its branches go outside, O Omed B'chutz V'nota Lefnim, or it's planted outside but its branches go inside, Mikeneged Achoma V'lefnim K'lefnim, Mikeneged Achoma Lechutz K'lechutz. So this is the image on the inverse of the page. It just depends, wherever you are territorially, that depends where you are. If you're in branches that are outside the boundary, you're outside. If you're inside, you're inside. That's in the context of Maaseh Sheni. So we've got two brightas. Where do I consider a tree to be? Does it depend on the branches, or does it just depend on kind of laterally where you are territorially?
Kohanim have branches. So Kohanim can't be, if the tree is inside the cemetery and hanging out of the fence,
so this is interesting. In the case, sometimes this comes up. There's a road here. I think it's a, what's the baseball player?
Jackie Robinson.
Thank you. There you go. Jackie Robinson. Is it a highway? Yeah. So there, I think it goes past the Jewish cemetery, and there are some trees that hang over. So Kohanim often have questions, am I allowed to drive underneath? So that, it turns out, it's not like you're transported inside the cemetery. It's a question of ohel. Does it count as a tent? So it turns out, oddly enough, if a Kohen was in the tree, it might not be an issue. That might depend on whether you're over or under, because you're not being sheltered by it, but it's about being under the canopy. So this is, if you're under the canopy, it won't make a difference to you. If you're outside the, you make like you're outside. The question is, if I'm hanging onto the branches and I'm outside, is it as if I'm inside? So according to one, everything follows the branches. So it could be I'm sitting on a tire swing attached to a tree that is planted outside Eremit Klut. But the branches are inside, so I'm considered inside. It doesn't matter where the roots are. But it sounds like from another Mishnah, when it comes to trees, everything depends on where you are boundary-wise. It doesn't matter where the branches are. Maser, so first one is Mikaneged. Maser, Ari Miklat Karamit, you're comparing two unlike cases, oranges and apples. The idea that in Maser Sheni, everything depends on whether you're inside or outside the city. It's got nothing to do with the Eremit Klut, where everything follows the branches. Maser b'chol metala rachmana. When it comes to Maser, everything depends on the firm boundary. Eremit Klut b'dira tala rachmana. And this comes back to that notion we've said, the whole point of going into Eremit Klut. Why did we say you can't live in tunnels under the Midrash, even though everybody else can? Because the point of being Eremit Klut is to live there, is to understand what it means to be part of society. So if we're trying to determine the boundaries of Eremit Klut, everything should go by where is it possible for you to live. And when it comes to a tree, anybody have a tree house growing up? Yeah? Anybody got a tree house right now? No. So where do tree houses tend to be built in a tree? In the branches or on the trunk?
In
the branches. So the branches are a place where you can live. So everything with Eremit Klut, that's how boundaries work. Maser Sheni has got nothing to do with living in a tree. Nothing to do with where is the city limit. Eremit Klut's got everything to do with where might I be able to live in the context of the city. And it turns out the tree may have a very long trunk that's planted outside the boundary. But as long as the residential part of this object is within the city, I could live here in the city. So everything follows the branches. Benofo metadale bikarila metadale full stop. Second line up. Rami masa amase. Now we're going to have and for me, even though this was kind of the most dense part of the page, and Alt Scroll treats the last Ahmed we just did with like 45 pages, the next 12 lines, in theory, can be quite complicated just in terms of trying to keep straight of what's where. So we're now going to say, we're going to contrast two views of where Maser Sheni boundary works. So far, we've had one Mishnah that says everything follows the boundary limit. In a tree, just matters where the wall is. Doesn't matter. Branches, trunk. If you're over the wall, you're over the wall. If you're inside, you're inside. Full stop. That's one Mishnah Maser Sheni. But now, to Tanya, we're going to have another brighter that says, B'Yushalayim halach ach anof, Bari Miglet halach ach anof. We've got a brighter that says, same view as our Mishnah. You always follow the branches. So we've now got two Mishnahs. Ari Miklat has now been put to the side. And we're just talking about Maser Sheni. You've got one Mishnah that says, Maser Sheni, you follow the branches. And one view says, Maser Sheni, you follow the wall. Wherever the wall is the outer limit. How are we going to resolve the contradiction? Like, Kasha HaRabbi Yehuda HaRabbanu. We say, one view is Rabbi Yehuda, who follows our Mishnah, and says everything follows the branches, HaRabbanu, and the Rabbanu says you follow the wall. We're now going to spend some time trying to explore Rabbi Yehuda's view, that even in Maser Sheni, you follow the branches. Detanya, we have a brighter turning over the page. Rabbi Yehuda, Omer Rabbi Yehuda says, B'mara halach, maybe we'll just fly through it and we'll pretend we understood all the details. Rabbi Yehuda, Omer Rabbi Yehuda says, B'mara halach achar pidcha, B'ilan halach anafenofa. Rabbi Yehuda says straightforwardly, when it comes to Eremit Klut, you follow the when it comes to trees, you follow the branches. When it comes to caves, you follow the opening. Meaning, let's say I live in a cave. The entrance to the cave is in Eremit Klut, but it goes underground. It goes very far, way outside the boundary. Wherever the entrance is, that's what the cave is tied to. That's its view. And when it comes to trees, wherever the branches are, that's what it's tied to. Sounds like Rabbi Yehuda follows that view, that you always follow the branches. And therefore, he might agree with our Mishnah when it comes to Eremit Klut, and he might agree with the brighter when it comes to Maser Sheni. You always follow the branches. And the rabbis disagree. They think it follows the wall. But that's fine. They're the exception now. Gemara is now going to try to complicate this unnecessarily by saying maybe Rabbi Yehuda won't agree with our Mishnah. Maybe when it comes to Maser Sheni, he thinks you follow the branches. But when it comes to Eremit Klut, you don't always follow the branches, because maybe Rabbi Yehuda is a classical rabbinic figure. And what do rabbis always want to do when it comes to halacha? What do we always want to do when it comes to halacha? Stereotypically? Complicate it in favor of? Well, machlokes and? Stringency. Rabbis always want to be strict, always want to be machmir. So maybe Rabbi Yehuda, when he says you follow the branches of Maser Sheni, That's because he wanted to be machmir with Maaseh Sheni. But Irmiklat, maybe he wouldn't have followed the branches. Now, why would it be machmir to follow the branches of Maaseh Sheni? So there are two details about Maaseh Sheni that's important. Maaseh Sheni is every year three and six, if I'm not mistaken, in the agricultural cycle, and it alternates with Maaseh Ani. So you've got Maaseh Sheni. Where do you have to eat Maaseh Sheni? Has to be eaten in Yerushalayim. It is treif to eat Maaseh Sheni outside Yerushalayim. Let's say Yerushalayim is very far away. You're not going to make it to Yerushalayim. What can you do to save yourself the trip? You can redeem it and kind of redeem it for money and then use the money to... you can redeem it for money, send money to the Beit Mikdash instead and eat the food where you are. Where are you not allowed to redeem it? Where do you have to eat it and you can't redeem it? Yerushalayim. So you now got this apple in your hand. Let's say it's a Maaseh Sheni apple. You're holding it. If you're in Yerushalayim, you have to eat it. You're not allowed to redeem it. If you're outside Yerushalayim, you are not allowed to eat it. You have to redeem it. And you can't...
bring it to Yerushalayim.
Or you can bring it to Yerushalayim. So now what happens if you're standing on a tree? I mean, answer is get out of the tree. But let's say you're standing on a tree and you can't get down. You've been chased by a wolf and you're starving hungry. You've been up there for half an hour. This is not an unusual case. You're stuck in a tree holding an apple. And now you need to know, do I have to redeem this to eat it? Or am I not allowed to redeem this? I'm standing in a tree. I'm not sure. The wall is here. The branches are out. The trunk's inside. Am I in Yerushalayim or not? Do I redeem it or not? So it could be. There's a chumrah in both directions. Meaning if I'm outside Yerushalayim, I'm not allowed to eat it. If I'm inside Yerushalayim, I'm not allowed to redeem it. So maybe Rabbi Yehuda says you have to always follow the branches, lechumrah, and assume if the branches are outside, what are you not allowed to do if you're standing on the trunk? Branches are outside, what are you not allowed to do? Not allowed to eat it. Let's say the branches are on the inside and you're standing on the trunk. What you're not allowed to do? Redeem it. So you always follow, maybe that's what Rabbi Yehuda means when it comes to Maaseh Sheni. You always follow the branches, lechumra, which means in Ari Miklat, there was only a chumra in one direction. Let's say the branches are outside. Let's say the branches are inside Ir Miklat, and you're the exilee, you're standing on the trunk. What lechumra would we say you have to follow if you're the Goel Adam? Branches inside your miklat, you're on the trunk.
You can't either.
Don't kill him.
Yeah.
So you say, don't kill him. Yeah. That's a chumra. I say, don't kill him. Go mach, but you can't kill him. Let's say the branches are outside your miklat and he's on the trunk. If you follow the branches, what happens?
You
can kill him. That's lakula. So he wouldn't say you always follow the branches. Maybe. Second line, maybe he only follows chumra when it comes to maaser, which is why he says follow the branches. In the case where the trunk is outside and the branches are inside, you'd say don't redeem it ever because you're being machmir. If the branches are outside, just as you can't eat it outside on the branches, so maybe you also shouldn't eat it on the trunk inside without redeeming the chumri both ways. But following your miklat, if the branches are inside, there's a chumra there. You can't kill him when he's on the trunk. But if the branches are outside, you're going to start saying you can kill him if he's standing on the trunk. Ha, gavaika. You now got this crazy case where somebody's standing on a trunk inside Ir Miklat, and we're saying, you go, Ladam, with your sniper rifle sitting outside, can take him out. Oh, he's on a trunk, and the branches are outside. How can it be? That's Lakula. You're letting you kill someone on the basis of the branches. Rebuta would never agree with that. So problem is back. Maybe our Mishnah disagrees with everything happening with Rabbi Yehuda. Can't follow Rabbi Yehuda either. That's what it sounds like. Amar Rava. So Rava's now going to try to resolve everything and say, maybe this is how we understand the Mishnah as following Rabbi Yehuda. Biikaro, if the so we're now talking about the case where the branches are outside. So this specific case on the image you have here, we're talking about the left-hand image. So you've got the trunk is inside, the branches are outside, and our exilee is being ridiculous and irritating and hanging out on the trunk just to make rabbis scratch their heads. So he's standing left there. This is the case we're talking about. Ikaro, if he's standing on the trunk, maybe everybody agrees. When we say you follow the branches, it doesn't mean you can kill him in this case. You can't kill him in this case. Everybody agrees. He's standing inside Ir Miklat on the trunk. You can't kill him. Kai Benofo, if he's standing, we don't have this image, but imagine that left-hand image, he climbed up into the branches. So he's hanging in the branches outside of Ir Mikla. Kai Benofo, Yachal Harga Bechitzib Ritzroros, if he's standing there and you can kill him with stones or arrows, meaning if you're on the ground underneath and you can shoot him out the tree, everybody agrees. You can take him out. He's in the branches. The branches are outside Ir Miklat. You follow the branches. Everybody would agree. But everybody agrees in that case, including the rabbis, including Rabbi Yehuda, including everybody. Kiplige, when is there an argument? You think we're thinking about crazy cases. So here's the case where the argument is. Kiplige b'mahavi ikaro draga lenofo. Where you are the goal, Adam. You don't have stones. You don't have arrows. You don't have any weapon of any kind, and you're desperate to kill this guy. How are you going to kill him? You got no weapons. What's the only way to kill him?
Shake the tree.
It's a hard tree. It's not going to fall down.
Shake the tree.
It's not going to fall. There's only one way to kill the guy.
Choke him.
Choke him. You've got to strangle the guy. That's the only way you're going to kill him. How do you strangle a guy from the ground? You can't. You've got to climb up. So now the question is, can the Goel Adam go into the Ir Miklat to climb up the trunk on the inside to kill him in the branches? Or that's going to be the question. Or do we say, you are not allowed to use resources of the Ir Miklat to commit this act of vengeance?
Isn't he in the trunk?
Who is?
All of them.
Oh, so this is at the edge of the trunk. He's gone for a walk in the Migrash, and he's climbing up a tree, and he's hanging outside the trunk. And
what if he's like on both? Well, then I guess he's not over the wall.
Right, meaning so he has to be
halfway in the branches, but still is it's a course of
like,
so there's
a Gemara in Bava Batra where the Gemara in Bava Batra says if you find a bird 50 amos away from a dovecot, a shovach, it belongs to whoever finds it. If it's within 50 amos, it belongs to the owner. And Rabbi Yirmiyahu says, what happens if you find a bird with 1 foot on the inside, 50 amos, and 1 foot on the outside?
Exactly.
And what happens in the Gemara? They kick him out. They say, get out of here. We're not interested in those questions. At which point, everybody else
that's
turns around. Right, and then everybody turns around and say, that's where you draw the line? I mean, we've got a lot of questions. But yeah, I guess at some point, the Gemara was like, okay, good point. I don't know, cut the bird in half. But yeah, it's a good question. And I guess for our purposes, you'd have to be fully over the boundary. So he's hanging in the branches. He's hanging over the trum. If we follow the branches, he's outside. And we've said, according to everybody, you can kill him if you've got an arrow. But I don't have an arrow. Can I climb up the tree and kill him there? I guess what's the easiest way? Use a ladder. Bring a ladder, put it outside the trum and climb up. I don't have a ladder, so I'm going to have to climb up the tree to get in there. Mar Sava, first line is the Ikro. We're going to finish with this yellow. Mar Sava, Mar says, we've got three lines. Mar Sava, have a Ikaro Draga Lenofo. According to one view, it is all in service to the branches. And therefore, you can climb up. And the other view says you can't use Ir Miklat to climb up, even though in theory you follow the branches and you can kill him if you're outside. So Rabbi Huda would say everything follows the branches. In this case, you can use Ir Miklat for that end. Full stop. Rav Ashi's got a completely different view. Says, let me save you 25 lines and suggest another way we can have Rabbi Yehuda square with our Mishnah, which is, when it says, Achar Hanof, everything follows the branches, Af Achar Hanof, it means you even follow the branches, and Rabbi Yehuda would say, always go Lechumra. So what Rav Ashi does is, and he's the bottom line figure in many of the Gemara's discussions, Ravina Rav Ashi is seen as the last Amoraim who kind of solidify the tradition. And his view is, when the Mishnah says, when it comes to Ir Miklat, we always follow the branches. It means we even follow the branches if it's Lachumra. Which means if somebody's in a tree, if they are in a... We always determine them to be inside the boundary, basically. If they are on the trunk, if the trunk is outside, we're going to follow the branches Lachumra that you can't kill them. And if they are on the branches outside, we follow the trunk as if they're inside Lachumra. And if you're on the tree, you're always considered in. So bottom line for Rav Ashi is, when it comes to boundary question, Masa Sheni, it is about the city limit. It doesn't matter where the tree is, wherever you are, if you're outside, you're outside, you're inside, you're inside. When it comes to Ir Miklat, we try to keep you in as much as possible because we are trying to rehabilitate you. You are being ridiculous. Stop going for blind hikes in the Migrash and ending up in the branches. But at the end of the day, we're going to try to keep you in as much as possible. You're not going to be living under the ground. You have to be living in the city. And we have to make sure this tries to rehabilitate you as much as possible. Full stop. What we'll do next time, the next two Mishnayos talk about cases if you kill somebody inside Ir Miklat? What happens if I'm an accidental killer, I was sent on exile, and then I kill somebody in Ir Miklat? Do I get exiled again, or am I already in exile? I guess this question comes up, Lahavdil, if somebody commits murder in jail, and they're in life sentence in jail, and they kill somebody, what are the consequences? Say again? Right, so let's say I had a life sentence. Let's say I've got a life sentence. So what happens now? So you get multiple life sentences. But yeah, I'm living here. What difference does it make to me? I don't know the answer to that. I guess just solitary confinement. There's a way to ratchet it up. So if I'm sent into exile and I kill somebody in exile, we're like, okay, I guess it's not working yet. Just keep at it. Or do we have to take some measures? And then we'll talk about what happens if... Right, you're going to make him live in the tree. And then give him some answer shady and make him figure it out. And then we'll finish off this perek next week, and we'll ask a question about whether the rehabilitation fully works. When you come out of exile, can you re-enter society, or are you still labeled an accidental killer? Can you be a witness, for example? Are you a freshly born citizen? This comes up in the United States. I don't know what the rule is in New York, but there are rules about felon voting. Right, that if you were ever incarcerated, it doesn't matter if you're out now, but you can't vote. Is that true in New York?
Not if the Democrats have anything to say about it.
Right, so, well, they do in New York, so I don't know what the rules are.
They want to change the rule to make it that I think ex-convicts can vote.
But currently ex-convicts cannot vote. So I know this came to a head in Florida a couple of years ago where they tried to change the law. I can't remember which direction it was, but there was a rule that your ex-convicts can't vote, and then it wanted to change the law, but... I understand convicts shouldn't vote, but if you've come out of jail and you've been rehabilitated through the parole board and you're trying to get a job and we want you to enter society, are you allowed to vote? So the question will be, if you've been through exile and the high priest dies and you come out, are you a clean slate? Or is this, you never can really enter society and we're just mitigating the damage that you can do? That's how we'll finish the parak next time, and then we'll turn to the next parak, which will actually be about Marcus, about lashes. But in the meantime, thank you for your patience. Everybody take a breath. Benching.